will call the meeting to order. Let's start with the roll call. If you are here, please log in. 25 board members present. That is a quorum. Let's continue with the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, we're going to start with the chair's report, and all I have under my report is the report from the Criminal Justice Management Council. This is a presentation that members of the council have been presenting at various organizations, such as the Planners for Rotary and Family Policy Board. They gave the presentation to my class last fall, basically as a way of getting the word out to the community in terms of what we do here in La Crosse County in the area of criminal justice. And the reason that we wanted to have it scheduled for this evening, again, is kind of a lead-up to what I have talked about on a number of occasions, that March 3rd town hall meeting that's going to be taking place, co-sponsored by the La Crosse Tribune and Channel 19, that will be held in the jail. So the more information that we can get out to people, we feel the better off we are in terms of the community understanding really where we're coming from and realizing that we are trying to control our fate as opposed to letting things just happen and we react to them. I think that this is a very much a proactive approach that we're taking with regard to criminal justice, and we are a model for not just the state of Wisconsin, but I think the entire Midwest in that respect. The two people who are here are familiar to both of you, Jane Claycamp and Keith Belzer, so I'm going to ask them to come forward.
Need to speak in there for recording purposes. For those of you who recall, I'm much happier to be here this time than the last time I was here. On the Criminal Justice Management Council, when I was on the county board for the cup of coffee I had with y'all, we had a retreat at one point where it was discussed that there's an awful lot of people in the community who really don't know, first of all, what the Criminal Justice Management Council is, and then secondly, what it really does. And at that point, we talked about, and this would have been, you know, maybe 5-6 years ago, putting together a PR committee. And at that point, I volunteered to start a PR committee. And it took me leaving the county board for 4 years and coming back onto the Criminal Justice Management Council 4 years later for me to actually follow through on my promise when I was on the county board. And so when I came back to the Criminal Justice Management Council, I really thought it was important that we get a PR committee to do a couple of things. Number one, to talk about what the council is. People like Mike Desmond, who's doing a great job on the council right now, will tell us the first time we have a retreat with new members that they may have heard of it before, but other than maybe seeing a letter in the paper asking people to apply, they don't really know what it does. And I think that's a failure. An awful lot of our tax dollars go to the criminal justice system, whether it's at the county level, the state level, or the federal level. And as part of transparency and responsibility, we owe it to the taxpayers, the people in the community, the people who are the users of the system and hopefully not being used by the system. We owe it to everybody to let people know what our philosophy is, what we're doing, and why we're doing it. And that was the goal of putting together this particular presentation. This is one of a number of things we're doing. One of them, as you know, is the town hall meeting that's coming up, and I would hope to see some of you there. Some of you, I hope you stay home. No, I'm joking. I want to see you all there. In addition to the town hall, the other thing we've been working on a lot is this presentation that we're going to show to you today. Now, a number of you here have seen it either through the Criminal Justice Management Council or other presentations we've done. And it is a presentation designed specifically to bring information to community members who are not involved in the system, to give a little bit of a history of the criminal justice system in La Crosse, to talk about what the Criminal Justice Management Council is, what the philosophy is, and then how that philosophy is being implemented in our county with programming and things of that nature and decisions that are being made. Having said that, what I would ask is if any of you see something in here that you think could be tweaked a little bit, it's an ongoing process, please let Jane or myself know. The other two people who have worked an awful lot on this this particular presentation, Mike Desmond and Troy Harsey, who's on the Criminal Justice Management Council. He's the principal at Logan Middle School. And both these guys are going to be doing these presentations as well as myself and Jane. So I guess we will jump in. Where do I point this? There we go. All right, so what is the Criminal Justice Management Council? That's one of the things we want to talk about. I'm assuming most of you are going to have some sort of understanding of that, but maybe not. What are the principles of evidence-based practice for correctional clients? We'll talk about what is evidence-based practice, and in particular, how it applies to correctional clients. And then finally, how has evidence-based practice been implemented in following the philosophy of the Criminal Justice Management Council in La Crosse County? So by way of history, and this stuff I think is awfully interesting for those of you who were not involved in county government at the time, this is where the jail was for many years. This is this building, actually. It's the first time I've given this presentation, standing inside the building. The women's jail is still here until this Thursday, maybe, right? Is the last I heard is that the women are maybe being moved over to the new jail addition on Thursday, which will be then the last remnants of a jail in this building. But for a long time, this was the main jail. In 1965, by way of reference, there were 15 to 20 inmates per day on average. I think of that as the Mayberry years. In the 1980s, we took our very frightening Huber release prisoners, and we rented 10 rooms for them at the Ivy Motel, and that was our work release center. So they would check into a motel at night and spend the night in the motel, and then leave the next day. I assume we weren't giving them, you know, turndown service and mints on their pillows, but nonetheless, we were renting 10 rooms at a motel at that time. And then 1987, we added 54 beds for work release in this building, and those would have been in what is now the printing department up on the first floor. And then at some point when we opened a Huber Center, which was the old Montgomery Ward's auto shop, that place, which had been Huber, which is now the printing center, became a medium security part of the jail as well. And then by 1992, we had gone from 15 to 20 inmates in 65. In about 20 years, we had increased tenfold to 160 inmates per day, and that led to overcrowding and concerns about what we were going to do in the future. A consultant was brought in. The consultant predicted in 1992 that by last year we would need a 400-bed jail. That was a lot of beds, but more importantly, a lot of cost. The estimated cost for that 400-bed jail was over $36 million. Now, there are some of the people in this room that I believe were on the county board at that time. As you might imagine, that caused a lot of consternation, even in the relatively flush years of 1992. So people were concerned, and what happened is we developed the Sentencing Strategies Committee. The Sentencing Strategies Committee is the precursor to what is currently the Criminal Justice Management Council. The Sentencing Strategies Committee had the following members, among others. Some of them I think they're sort of interesting. Judge Montalban, Judge Pappas, the District Attorney Horn, who now is a judge, of course, Sheriff Halverson, and the bottom three are the ones that I find the most interesting.
Keith, you got to talk into the microphone. Sorry.
Judges tell me the same thing. Wandering feet. The bottom three are the ones that I find the most interesting. Mike Hipsch, who I think by anybody's estimation would be considered conservative, and certainly fiscally conservative. I'm not even going to touch anything about that right now. On the other hand, John Mettinger, who I assume is here somewhere, right? There he is. I don't think this is offensive. I think by most people's consideration would be considered very liberal. And then Steve Doyle, and I don't know what to say about Steve.
The less the better.
Fair enough. In going back and looking at the history and talking to people, my sense was that Steve was really the person who was pragmatic about the approach. But what is really interesting to me, and John, at some point, if you want to pipe in here with anything, because I talk about you in this presentation all the time with ever actually having talked to you, I make certain assumptions. But that's what lawyers do. You know that. But what I think is interesting is that we have people from clearly opposite sides of the aisle who came together to look at what is the best future of this county. In Mike Hipsch's case, $36 million is too much. There was no way we were going to be able to afford to raise taxes enough to pay $36 million for a new jail. In John Mettinger's case, my understanding is, having talked to him about criminal justice issues over the years, where's the rehabilitation? Where's the programming? That's another way that we can avoid having to just lock people up in jail. I'm not misstating here, am I, John? All right. Shocking. That would be the first time. So what happened is, and I'm going to talk more about this later, and there's an article on your desk that hopefully I'll remember to reference, but you had this idea of people coming at this from completely divergent points of view, coming to a consensus on the best way to handle things, and that was reduce crime and reduce costs, with the reducing crime being, strangely enough, more effective when you reduce costs. And that's where we find ourselves, both in this county, statewide, and there's a national movement along these same lines. So the Sentencing Strategies Committee came up with three recommendations. Number one, we're not going to spend $36 million. We're going to build a smaller jail. But in order to do that, we have to do two other things. We have to develop smart alternatives to incarceration. In other words, we're not just going to, you know, let people do whatever they want. We have to have other things, other ways of controlling people, of monitoring people, of knowing what people are doing. And then finally, we also have to decrease crime through effective programming. I think of this as a three-legged stool. I know that's an overused metaphor, but I think it's apt in this situation. If you're going to build a smaller jail, you have to do the other two. You have to have the alternatives to incarceration, or you're just going to fill up the jail, and you also have to do the programming to reduce recidivism, or you're going to find yourself in that same position a number of years later. So these are the recommendations. This is what the Sentencing Strategies came back with. The County Board said, yes, 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 we're going to do all three. In 1995, as the first step, Justice Sanctions was created to implement the programs identified by the Sentencing Strategies Committee as crime-reducing and cost-effective. And this is a phrase that you're going to hear throughout this presentation, and again, is really at the forefront of this national movement as well. And as a part of the 1995 decision to begin Justice Sanctions, Jane Claycamp was hired and brought in to develop that programming, to develop the alternatives to incarceration that would be cost-effective but still create a safe community, and to, you know, have programs, different ideas, as identified by the committee, that would reduce crime. The problem was we built a smaller jail, and we hired Jane, and there's nothing after that end. So while Jane was able to find some alternatives to incarceration, there was really not the focus on that. Once the smaller jail was agreed to, the focus sort of died off. So in 1997, we opened the new law enforcement center and jail. There were 172 secure beds, 172. There was a receiving area, medical cells, and the cost was $20 million. Now, obviously, that's still not a drop in the bucket, $20 million. On the other hand, compared to $36 million, that's a huge savings. So we opened that in 1997. By the time it opened, keep in mind we had 172 secure beds. By the time the doors actually opened, we were up to an average daily population of 194. In 1999, now for those of you who are like me, a little deficient in math, through no fault of the public school system, it was my own responsibility, but nonetheless, this is only 2 years later. 2 years later, we had Sheriff Weisenberger in the unenviable position of having to come back to this august body and ask for a larger jail, 2 years after we had spent $20 million. It wasn't his fault. We were already filling up the jail. Go back to the three-legged stool. We did the one leg. We didn't do the other two. The stool was toppling over. We were filling up the jail. So Sheriff Weisenberger came back, said, look, we need more jail. And the same thing happened that happened back in 92, except this time, instead of the Sentencing Strategies Committee, we put together something called a Criminal Justice Management Council. It's a model that existed in many jurisdictions around the United States. We modeled it after the other jurisdictions, and we put together our own, and that's, in fact, the council that some of you are members of, and we have citizen members of, that currently exists and creates the philosophy of criminal justice in La Crosse County. by county ordinance. Whoops, let me do this first. This might be in the ordinance, I don't know. This is the mission statement, and like many mission statements, it's a little wordy. I think everyone has to have their own individual word if they worked on this committee that makes it into the final statement, if any of you have ever worked on a mission statement. So if you did work on this mission statement, perhaps later you can identify which was your word. But nonetheless, here's our mission statement. It was implemented to design and develop a comprehensive criminal justice system that ensures a just, coordinated, and accountable system of services on behalf of the citizens of La Crosse County. In other words, what we're trying to do is reduce crime and reduce costs. It all comes back to the same thing. If you can do both of those things, you're doing it right. So we created the Criminal Justice Management Council. By ordinance, it must have these members: the judiciary, which is currently Judge Gonzalez, the sheriff speaks for itself. In addition to the sheriff, Captain Daggett, who runs the jail, is at almost all of the meetings. Local police departments are represented by Bob Lawrence, who's a liaison with the La Crosse Police Department, Chief Mike McHugh from Holman, and the Onalaska Police Chief, is my understanding, is also a member. Probation and Parole, Bill Hammes, District Attorney Tim Grinke. We have somebody from Victim Services, a mental health representative, the Public Defender, the new Director of Human Services, County Board members that I'm never sure, I think it's five or six from the County Board. Is that about right? And then seven citizen members, of which myself, I'm one, Mike Desmond's one, some of the other people I mentioned earlier. So the Criminal Justice Management Council, once it was created, requested time from the Law Enforcement Judiciary Committee to research and make recommendations regarding community safety and cost reduction. We're in that same position where we had people, again, from both sides of the aisle. Why aren't we doing the program? Why aren't we looking at ways to reduce recidivism that aren't jail time? And at the same time, we have people saying, look, we just spent $20 million. By this time in 2001, money's getting a little tighter, and as you know, that's a sad story that just keeps getting sadder. So people were really concerned about, we got to figure this out, and we got to do it the right way. We can't just keep building bigger and bigger. So one of the things that we ask community members when we're talking about this stuff, and I'm just going to throw it out to all of you as well, how many of you, when you hear about or you see in the paper or on television or you hear on the radio somebody's committed a crime, how many people want to see that person punished? An awful lot of liberals here. I would think everybody would want to see somebody punished to some extent. On the other hand, when we're talking about really what we want, the more interesting question, I think, is how many people would want to see someone change their behavior, right? I mean, it's sort of impossible not to agree with that. That's really what we want to do. When we think of punishment, what we're thinking about, for most of us, I mean, sometimes we're just sort of frustrated. You know, somebody's in trouble over and over again. If you have teenage boys, no, never mind. You get frustrated with people at times, and you want to punish them out of anger. But really, when we're looking at the Criminal Justice Management Council from a philosophical point of view, what we want to look at is how are we going to change that behavior? Because that creates cost reduction, obviously, right? If people stop committing the same crime over and over again. And then it also makes our community safer. If we change someone's the way they think, the way they operate, the way they act, that's going to make us all safer, and it's going to be more cost effective. I had a sort of epiphany of sorts when the first time I was on the Criminal Justice Management Council, when I was shirking my duties by not creating this committee. We had a meeting with the Judiciary and Law Committee when Mark Carey was hired to come in and consult with us and do a systems-wide survey and talk to a lot of people. And for some reason, I had heard people like Jane Claycamp and others say something for years. And what they would say is this: jail does not deter crime. Jail doesn't deter crime. Now, most of you know that I primarily make my living as a criminal defense attorney. But I got to tell you, when I would hear that, I thought it was a bunch of liberal hogwash. I mean, I just didn't believe it. I said, well, sure, I know. You got social scientists say it doesn't deter crime. And I do know the studies about the death penalty, and that doesn't deter crime. But somehow, that seemed substantively different to me than the person who's doing stupid stuff on the street. And so Mark Carey says this to the group, and of course I raise my hand because I'm so bright, and I say, did you just say jail doesn't deter crime? And he said, no. And I said, ever? Not for anybody? And he said, no. And what I came to understand is it doesn't for a couple of reasons. Number one, for jail or prison, and I'm using both of those interchangeably in this situation, to be a deterrent, it has to be two things. It has to be swift and it has to be certain. There are a handful of countries in the world where punishment actually serves as a deterrent. Some countries in the Middle East and China. Now, I've been to China to speak to public defenders there. And the reason that punishment works as a deterrent in China is that if somebody accuses you of a crime today, you'll be arrested today, you'll have a trial in 2 to 3 weeks, very, very likely you'll have confessed, the attorneys can never bring up what caused the confession, or the attorney will go to prison. In other words, you can never accuse the state of having beat somebody, for instance, coerced a confession, or the attorney goes to prison, yet it happens regularly. If the person doesn't confess, and this would be any crime, the proverbial loaf of bread is the example, and this is no exaggeration. If the person doesn't confess, they have the trial in 2 to 3 weeks. The trial is in front of a three-judge tribunal. One of the judges is a Communist Party member. The other two are appointed by the Communist Party. And those three people decide if you're guilty or not. If you're guilty, you are shot in the back of the head the next morning, and your family receives a bill for the cost of the bullet. That's justice, right? Now, that is a deterrent, because people know that if they do something, even if they're accused of it, the punishment will be swift and it will be certain because it happens to everybody. But there's no due process. And many, many innocent people are convicted and executed or make false confessions because the alternative is that you'll be executed, and the loaf of bread that I was referring to will cost you 25 to 30 years in prison. So you have to make that choice. I don't think there's a person in this room who thinks that that trade-off is worth having a punishment be a deterrent. Now, there is a situation in which incarceration, not used simply as punishment, can in fact change behavior, not as a deterrent. And by deterrent, what I'm saying is, if Jim here goes out and commits a crime, by not talking into the microphone, for instance, Jim here goes out and commits a crime, specific deterrence would indicate that if we put him in jail, then when he gets out, he won't commit that same crime again. Well, we know that's not working, right? Because we keep locking people up and they keep committing the same crimes. General deterrence would work in this way. If Jim commits a crime, we put him in jail, and Sharon hears about it, then she won't commit that crime. We know that that doesn't work either, right? Now, keeping somebody in a custodial situation can change behavior in sort of limited situations. My understanding of the research, and Jane is the expert on this stuff, but if you put somebody in a custodial situation who's got treatment issues, addiction issues, behavioral issues that can be modified, for a minimum of 9 months, between 9 and 18 months, and you give them intense treatment, and then you release them and you give them the same sort of treatment, then that can create behavioral change. And it's not due to the punishment, it's due to the re-education, really, of the person. You're changing the way they think, you're changing the way they behave. The problem is we don't have those sort of wraparound programming. We might do intensive programming in a confined setting, in a prison setting, and now we're starting to do some of that here. And actually, La Crosse might be a place where we're doing some of this. But in the prison setting, you might get that intensive treatment, but then you get back out and there isn't the wraparound, for all kinds of reasons that you can figure out for yourself. The problem is, all we've done is we've taught that person how not to use drugs in prison. We haven't taught them what to do when they're back outside prison again. So they're two different learning skills. Once we know that punishment per se, punishment as punishment, the most obvious is jail, prison isn't working, then we gotta figure out what does work. And that brings us to evidence-based practice, which Jane's gonna talk about.
Okay. So, historically, we thought that people would stop behavior through punishment, which I don't need to go through because Keith just explained why. That doesn't work. Humiliation, that was back in the time where they would put people in stocks or sandwich boards or whatever it was. That doesn't work either. Or penitence, which is actually the word where penitentiary comes from, was that it was believed if you put people in a place where they could be reflective and quiet and think about their actions, they would change their behavior. And that might work for some people, but generally speaking, it does not work with the people who are in the criminal justice system. Not to say that some people in the criminal justice system can't be reflective, but the vast majority of the people that we work with on any given day would not take that time to be reflective and think about how they had wronged somebody. It just isn't something that they have the capability of doing. So we know that that does not work. So what do we try to do instead? So there are three things in the world of criminal justice that to focus on. The first is risk. What's the likelihood that someone is going to commit another crime? And risk is decided by, it's very simple, actually, to decide if someone's risky or not. It's how old you are, because I know you're all going to understand this. The younger one is, the more likely you are to get in trouble with the law. The second thing is the first time you got arrested. If you were young when you got arrested the first time, it's more likely you're going to get arrested again in the future. And the third thing is, how many times have you been arrested overall? So obviously someone who is a younger person who was arrested when they were 12 or 13, who's been arrested a number of times, they look very risky. That doesn't take into account any of the needs that someone has, which is the second piece. This is where it starts getting into just, are they risky, and should we lock them up because they're risky? And the example I try to give on this is that if someone who shoplifts every day would look like a high risk. If they shoplift every day, they started that when they were 13, they're 25 and they shoplift every day, they're obviously at a high risk to reoffend because they shoplift every day, and it's what they do. On the other hand, if tonight I went out and did something terrible, pick whatever that is that you want to pick on that, and tomorrow someone did a risk assessment on me, I would look like a low risk. I'm 43 years old. I've never been arrested before, and so I would look like a low risk, even though I had done something terrible. So you can see how there's a difference in just the risk. It doesn't mean that because I did something terrible tonight that I'm going to do that again tomorrow. It means I did something terrible tonight. The second thing that we focus on, and this is where there are different things that can help us do this, is that to focus on the need of the person. What are the different kinds of needs that they present that we could focus on that could actually reduce the behavior? And there's a slide later on, so I won't go into a lot of that. The third one is actually the most complicated, in my opinion, is the responsivity. That is, how motivated is the person to change? And it doesn't mean if they're not motivated, we can't try something, but it just takes a different skill set than someone who's motivated to change. It's no different than a person who wants to quit smoking versus a person who doesn't want to quit smoking. It's obviously a different skill set that one would use to try to convince them of that. It also matters for the responsivity piece. If I'm the person that the client is working with, do they like me? If they don't like me, it's less likely they're going to change. So all those things are taken into account. You know, what's their reading level? Do they have a mental health issue? Those are the things that are related to responsivity. There are 8 guiding principles when it comes to criminal justice, and I won't take a long time on any of these, but try to give a very short overview on each of them. Is the first thing is to do that risk and needs assessment that I talked about. So there are different areas to focus on, and you'll see that in the next slide. The second is to try to enhance their intrinsic motivation. We can do all kinds of things to try to enhance their extrinsic motivation, and we do all kinds of things to make that happen. Drug tests, alcohol tests, electronic monitoring, all of that stuff is what enhances extrinsic motivation. But we try through that and behavioral programming to get them to understand that they feel better when they're not using drugs or alcohol or whatever it may be. The third is to target the intervention. If someone needs help with their attitudes, values, and beliefs because they're negative, you don't send them to an employment program because the likelihood that they're going to be actually to keep that job once they get it is pretty low if they don't think jobs are important. It's in a nutshell. There's obviously a lot more to that. Skill training with directed practice, that's for both the client and the therapist or the person, the social worker, whoever's working with that person. We need to make sure that the social worker or the helping professional understands what the different skills that one needs to work with criminal justice clients. On the same manner, we need to make sure that the clients know how to do very basic social skills. Sometimes this can be as simple as, you know, how to greet somebody, how to shake a hand. I know that sounds oversimplified, but that's one of the things that they work on in some of the cognitive behavioral groups, is how do you help them understand how to ask for a day off from your job? And if the boss says no, what's your reaction? Do you swear at them and call them names and stomp off anyway, or do you have a meaningful interaction about why you need the day off? It's the very basic skill training. increased positive reinforcement. There is a lot of research that will indicate that for every negative thing we say to a criminal justice client, we have to say at least 4 decent things to them so that it overrides the negative thing. So, for example, if I say to someone who's in the criminal justice system, you know, today you had a test that was positive, meaning bad, for drugs, and the person knows that they're going to get some sort of a response for that that isn't positive, something a judge might be able to do or something that we can do as helping professionals is to say, okay, so you had a positive drug test today, which isn't good, and we're not going to try to say nice things about that because it's not good. But on the other hand, you know, I don't want you to sort of go down the path of using. So what's the longest period of time you've been clean? And it might be only a day or it might be a week, but you can focus on that. And you try to think of 4 things to say to them so they can focus on the positive as they walk out of the office rather than I'm going to jail, I might as well just go use again. There's a big difference in how to approach that. And then also engage in ongoing community support. So try to find help for them to find pro-social community members to hang out with rather than the antisocial. Again, that's much more complicated to do than what it should be. But if I asked all of you to go out tonight and try to find 8 new antisocial friends and to help you figure out how to rob a bank, that would be also complicated for you to do. So it's the same kind of thing. It's no different. And then we always have to try to figure out how to measure feedback. How do we know that we're doing what we're supposed to do? And then also make sure that the practices that we're doing are, again, focused and research-based so that we're not just sort of going off willy-nilly and doing anything we want to. These are the areas that we try to work on when it comes to the criminal justice population. So, for example, we wouldn't want to try to work on someone's self-esteem. Self-esteem for criminal justice clients, generally speaking, is not very effective. It's been shown to have maybe a little bit of effect with women, but hardly ever men. So the things that the biggest area to work on with criminal justice clients are their thinking patterns, attitudes, values, beliefs. That is really what we try to work on the most. And most recently, through the Transition from Jail to Community initiative, they brought in a trainer where every staff person was trained in a cognitive behavioral program. We've all taken a lot of motivational interviewing kinds of classes to help work with this population. So it's really focusing on the client's attitudes, values, and beliefs. That's the big one. And if you can get people to change their attitudes, values, and beliefs into something more pro-social than antisocial, that's about 90% of it right there. Obviously, other areas to work on are things that you would expect, who their friends are, who their peers are, drug and alcohol problems, what they do for fun, so that if what they do for fun is, you know, smoke marijuana, that's not a good pro-social thing to do. Education and employment, and I think those are it. So those are the areas that we should try to work on. But again, knowing that the most important is their attitudes and values and beliefs, and you can help people get 1,000 jobs, but if they have antisocial thinking patterns, it won't matter. Okay. So these are some of the recommendations of...
Can I jump in?
Yes.
I wanted to throw something out here with regard to the things that Jane's talking about. This information is not a bunch of, you know, left-leaning professors in a think tank at Berkeley, California. This information is put out by the National Institute of Corrections. Really, this is the best research we have. Evidence-based practice simply means what is the best research out there. There was a time where the best research we had in medicine was to use leeches. We don't use leeches anymore, right? We have other ideas based on the research. In the law, we're sort of slow to change. A lot of the things we've been doing for hundreds of years simply weren't working. The best example I can give of that is that when I started in lacrosse as a public defender, I had a sort of an unlimited amount of copies of a substitution of judge request for Judge Perlich. In any case I had, I substituted him. It was bad enough that I would get a new case. As soon as they would call the case, I'd walk up there and he'd hold out his hand waiting for the substitution for me. It was because, as a public defender, I thought that he wasn't the best judge to have for my clients. He had a reputation of sending people away and sending them away for a long time. Judge Perlich, for a number of years, would give people increasingly more incarceration on drug cases, trying to get drugs out of lacrosse, including longer and longer prison sentences. And he finally got to the point where he realized it wasn't working, right? There's that sort of cliched notion of having mental illness being that you keep repeating the same behavior over and over again, expecting things to change, and they don't. Well, that's sort of like our criminal justice system. We kept locking people up, longer and longer and longer, same people would get out and commit the same crimes. So he became very interested in alternative ideas, and then he, with Jane Claycamp, went around the country to learn from the federal government about drug courts and how to use drug courts and how effective they were compared to simply just locking somebody up. And that started the drug court movement. And quite honestly, that was one of the reasons I was interested in getting involved in the county board when I did, is that I saw that there were effective things, cost-effective, and in my mind, more importantly, there were things that could change behavior that could be done, drug court being one of them that Jane will talk about in a moment. The other thing is, I said earlier, you know, with the Sentencing Strategies Committee and now with the Criminal Justice Management Council, and it's important to know with the Criminal Justice Management Council, it's never a Democratic vote. It's always consensus. Everybody who is at that table has to feel like their needs are being met. Whatever they're going to need within that system, that has to be met. You don't simply vote something up or vote something down. You have to create consensus, if not synergy, which we take that to the next level. So we've seen that it created sort of, to use the old phrase, interesting bedfellows all the way back in 92. And what's interesting now is that for the first time, I'm hearing people who were at one point considered sort of what was the term in around 2000? Get tough on crime advocates like Newt Gingrich. And I gave you all an article there. And there's a website that he's a part of that looks at criminal justice issues at the national level from a very conservative point of view, using the same phrase that's been used by people looking at rehabilitation for years and years, and that is to get smart on crime. And by smart meaning cost effective, but also risk reduction. So I you know, ask you to take a look at the article when you get a chance, but this is a movement that now is moving nationally. The cost of building prisons that occurred in the late 90s and early 2000s have been the biggest drain on resources on many of the states throughout the United States. When California was looking at bankruptcy issues a few years back, there were studies that came out that said that the biggest reason for that was the huge prison growth rate that they had around the same time Wisconsin did. And my understanding is Wisconsin had the third highest prison growth rate around that same time, California being worst. Well, everybody's got to pay the piper now. We've got to find different ways to do it. And these are the different ways we're doing it.
So in 2001, La Crosse County expanded electronic monitoring. And that's one of those programs that is obviously has a huge cost savings compared to a jail bed, but it doesn't do much to reduce recidivism all on its own. Basically, it's you take people out of jail, you put them on electronic monitoring, and sometimes there can be programming as part of that. But a lot of times it's just taking those lower risk people who may not be likely to reoffend and putting them on electronic monitoring, which could, I suppose, in the long term also reduce recidivism if they aren't hanging around those higher risk people. In 2002, we implemented the drug treatment court. In 2005, we closed the work release facility. And just the other part about between the drug treatment court and the OWI treatment court is that those are two programs that were really established. The first two that were established to reduce recidivism. I mean, that was the whole purpose of that. And we've gotten smarter over time as to who we take into either the drug treatment court. Again, we focus now on more higher risk, higher needs kinds of people than we would have when it started. And also in the OWI treatment court, people who are lower risk, lower needs tend to graduate at a higher rate. Some of the we've been reviewing the OWI treatment court, and for people who successfully graduated from the OWI treatment court have a recidivism rate in OWIs of 8%, and the people who did not successfully complete OWI treatment court have a recidivism rate in OWIs of 20%. So we can see that there's a fairly significant difference there. And we keep looking at those kinds of things as we go on. In 2007, we completed the systems assessment, which a lot of recommendations have come out of. We're still working on some of those recommendations. They made over 100, and we're continuing to work on some of those, but I would say most of them have been done. We developed the Women's Community-Based Program in 2008. Obviously, you all were very involved in hearing about that, so I don't need to talk a lot about that. And then the jail also incorporated mental health screenings and increased mental health services in the jail. And last but not least, this is something I talked about a little bit earlier, is the TJC initiative, which is we were one of six counties nationwide to receive this technical assistance grant. There's no money attached to it, just technical assistance, where they're helping us focus on working with higher risk, higher needs people and reducing the barriers to treatment so that they don't come back into the system again. So the average daily population in 2001 was 297. In 2010, it was 172, which tells you that the jail population has changed quite a bit. This slide refers to the blue line is the average daily population of people who were in justice sanctions. So in 1997, we would have had an average daily population of 11 people we were taking out of the jail. Last year in 2010, it was 234. And those aren't all the people that we work with. Those are people who are on bail monitoring, who are sentenced, and in the electronic monitoring portion of the OWI treatment court. It doesn't include drug treatment court people. It doesn't include the people that we work with for diversion agreements or child support or child protection or any of those. It's just strictly the jail reduction kinds of programs. And the red line is the jail population. So it has sort of an inverse effect, I guess, in that in 1997, I can't read that number, what that is, 194, is that what it is? And then last year there was 172 people on an average day in a jail. I was just going to say this is more or less interesting than anything else, but in 2009, we took over 11,000 samples for drug testing. Which means that we watched most of those people give us a sample of urine. So that's what that means. And of those, there were over 40,000 tests done. So for each sample, there would have been about an average of four tests finished. And then we also estimate that we did over 140,000 alcohol tests in 2009.
I think there's two interesting things about this chart when I look at it. Number one, and I hope that this is a trend. Right now, obviously, we don't know if it's a trend or not, but I'm thinking optimistically that maybe it will be. If you look at both the jail population and the justice sanctions population, they've both gone down this year, right? Now, if that continues for a few years, we can start to see evidence that what we're doing is working. We're reducing recidivism. There are all kinds of things that go into that, arrest rates and demographics and that sort of thing, but it's the sort of thing that at least gives you some hope. The other thing, though, that's interesting is if you add together 234 and 172, you come up with 400 people, which is exactly what the consultant predicted in 1992. First of all, I find it amazing that in 1992, a person can look at the demographics of our county, trends in arrests and criminal justice, and come up with the fact that we'd have 400 people in the system and almost get it right on. But if we had decided instead to just build a large jail, all those people would be in custody. And what we know, as we've been talking about, is that jail doesn't reduce crime. And in fact, for low-risk offenders, there's research that shows it can increase crime. And the reason is this. Low-risk offenders are what are called self-correctors. And it's like most of us here. I dare say I can look at a couple of you, I know for sure, but I dare say most of us did something stupid when we were young, right? When we were, you know, in our teens, early 20s, I see people giving looks at each other out there. Most of us, if we did something stupid, whether we got caught or not, we're self-correctors. We're not going to keep doing it. We're not going to live a life of antisocial behavior. That's how a good percentage of the people that come in the justice system is. On the other hand, if you take a 19-year-old kid who does something really stupid, gets in trouble, and feels, you know, that's not who I am, that's not who I'm going to be, and you put that person in a jail setting where what that 19-year-old did is nothing compared to the people who are in the jail, suddenly what they did doesn't seem so bad. It seems like it's more the norm rather than an exception in that person's life. And that's a way in which putting people in jail who are low risk and self-correctors can actually increase crime, because then it takes away the stigma, takes away the self, the way one looks at oneself. So what we're doing then is that we are using electronic monitoring, which, as Jane said, is no more effective at reducing recidivism by itself than a jail is, but it doesn't increase it, and it's much more cost-effective, right? But then we're also adding the programs, which is hopefully leading to those the two lines going down together.
I think we can both maybe talk about these next two slides. But one of the questions that I get asked a lot is just about the budget. So in 2010, the justice sanctions piece of the budget was $1.9 million, and the jail is $6.3 million. the total bed day saved, and that's a number that for every person we take out of the jail, for every day, we count that as a bed day. It's the same as the number of people in jail on a given day counts as a bed day. So on justice sanctions, there was about 91,000 bed days saved or not used, and then in the jail, there was a little over 66,000 bed days used last year. For justice sanctions, it costs about $21 a day to keep somebody on justice sanctions and about $96 a day to keep somebody in the jail. And part of that is that there's a huge range of services that happens with someone who's in justice sanctions. Someone in the drug treatment court is going to get a lot more services over a longer period of time than someone who's on electronic monitoring for 30 or 60 or 90 days. So the average length of stay, I think, in the OWA treatment court is about 18 months. So you can tell that there's a lot more investment put into someone like that versus someone who's just on electronic monitoring.
So this is a famous quote from Judge Chalene from Winona. Some of you have probably heard this quote. In talking about these issues, he was talking about how frustrating it is sometimes when we see the same person back in jail again. We see the same person, you know, in the newspaper, they got their fourth bail jumping charge. And how we're like, well, lock this person up already, would you? And what he was talking about, and the research supports this as well, you got to figure out who are you mad at and who are you afraid of. The people that we're afraid of, we need to lock up. I'll be the first person to absolutely agree with that. The people we're afraid of, we need to lock up. There are people that, for whatever reasons, right, are sort of like rabid animals. We can't have them out in society because they're dangerous. On the other hand, the people we're afraid of, it's not cost-effective, and it doesn't reduce repeat criminal behavior to lock them up. And that's why there's, I think, a trend nationally to relook at these ideas, to figure out what is the difference. You know, one of the things that I think people wonder about sometimes when they'll see an article or hear a story about somebody being released on a signature bond for the third time is, why would a judge keep letting that person out? Well, leaving aside what I just said about being angry versus being afraid, the Wisconsin statute's pretty clear. A judge can only give somebody a cash bond if they are either dangerous, and in most cases, people are not thought to be dangerous, just a pain on our backside, or they're a flight risk. Those are the two criteria, one or the other, to give somebody a cash bond. So it's not that the judge is doing something outrageous. The judge is actually following the law. I think that's helpful to clear up some of that. The other thing that I think is helpful to clear up is justice sanctions does not decide who gets out under any way, shape, or form. Justice sanctions does not have the ability to have anybody arrested. They're not judges. They also do not make recommendations to the courts about who gets out or who doesn't. They supply objective risk assessment information. The judge looks at the risk assessment information. Here's an argument from a prosecutor. Here's an argument from a defense attorney, and then makes a decision. So I think there's some sort of misunderstanding about what happens in those types of hearings. I think that was the main. Do you have anything else to add? I think, Mike, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
Don't we have one more slide?
We never talk about that one. That one just gets on there in case somebody asks us a question.
Oh, okay. All right. Anybody have any questions? Bill Fian.
Well, this is a topic of interest to me. In my county board race, I happened to mention that I noticed an exponential increase in a line item of our budget called justice sanctions. So I decided after being elected that I was going to do some checking into that, and I also decided to be part of the Criminal Justice Management Council. So in a follow-up to that, I met with Jerry Huber along with Dan Ferries and Jane, and we asked some questions about, you know, what's going on with this program. And something I learned was that this program was created with a federal grant that paid the county about $900,000 a year, and that that grant money had gone away, and so that cost was now falling to the county taxpayers. So I do believe that this is an effective program. I think the county taxpayer needs to know that, you know, there is a significant investment in this program. But that investment is also paying some dividends in terms of the cost of incarceration. And on another related point, Jane had presented to the Health and Human Services Board, which I also serve on, and she was talking about the reduction in residential treatment costs. Those had gone from 900,000 to 1.1 million. And the report she showed us, I think it was in December, was that we were going to come in under 400,000 for last year for residential treatment. Part of the conversation that Supervisor Ferries and I had with Jane was about the virtues of mandatory treatment versus voluntary treatment. And my question to Jane is, has there been a change in the thinking about mandatory treatment? Is that why there's the reduction in the residential cost? Or what's the reason for that dramatic drop in residential treatment costs?
There's a couple of things. One is that many times it's drunk driving arrests and convictions that drive the numbers that go along with treatment. And the numbers for La Crosse County have basically been reduced. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but they have been reduced over the last few years, both arrests and convictions. So that's part of it. The other part of it is that it is not the belief that treatment doesn't work, the belief or that we shouldn't mandate it if people aren't interested, but it's the type of treatment. So the focus tends to be more on outpatient outreach services versus residential. So it's not that we don't support treatment. And today we were looking at some numbers, and the number of people that were funded for treatment are about the same. It's the type of treatment that's changed over the last couple of years. So that the numbers have been consistent, and again, I don't remember that because I did not prep for that tonight, but the numbers are about the same. It's the type of treatment that's different.
Other questions or comments?
Steve, can I just follow
Absolutely.
Up?
Absolutely.
And maybe I'm wrong about this. Now, I'm operating without a net now because we've gone over to the human services side of things. But it seems to me the logic would be similar for putting somebody in a jail or a prison, giving them treatment, and then putting them out. You're not really teaching somebody how not to abuse alcohol in the community. I mean, it seems to me that that's really the goal, is to teach somebody how to do this stuff in the community. Is that
yes.
accurate?
That's accurate. I mean, obviously what happens is you start to mix populations and pure substance abuse people get a little freaked out by that. But there is a difference, but it's certainly there is a difference about how do you learn how to live sober, how do you learn how to live crime-free in a supported environment or in a controlled environment versus in the community. So we're always trying to get people to focus on how to live the best way possible in the community versus in some sort of a controlled environment. So, yes, that's true.
Jim Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you asked, Keith, when you asked the question about do you feel people should be punished or the other question about changing behavior, of course, changing behavior is what we are striving for. But I didn't, really wasn't too excited about the punishment, and because I'm not, personally, I'm not in most cases, I don't want to see somebody punished. For me, it's more about accountability. Mm-hmm. Punishment, for me, focuses on the individual. Accountability focuses on the behavior. And I think sometimes you put a model, you put two questions up like this, it sometimes oversimplifies things. Of course, who are we afraid of? That's an important question. Who are we mad at? How about there are people who we're not necessarily mad at, but people that need to be held accountable. And certainly you would agree that there are some people that need to be held accountable.
I absolutely would agree with that, but what does that mean? I mean, is holding somebody accountable, putting them in jail, even though we know that won't change their behavior, we know it's extremely expensive, and we know for some people it will increase recidivism, or is holding somebody accountable forcing them to take the steps that will actually change their behavior? Mm-hmm. As a taxpayer, I'd rather see them held accountable that way.
I 100% agree. And that's why I think sometimes it's with the Justice Sanctions Program in the LAC building currently, you know, there's going to be more cooperation and there's going to be that presence. So if somebody is in jail, we can get them the help they need. If that's where they need to be, that, you know, I don't think we want to. I agree with the concept of what we're trying to talk about here with the purpose of the just sanctions. I believe that. I guess I want to make sure, and I think the public would feel the same way. I don't think the public is so much interested in punishment in most cases. They just want to make sure people are held accountable. We can debate that. What does that mean? Maybe it doesn't mean jail. Maybe it's some other form of accountability. I guess my other question was regarding the cost of, you had a comparison of cost with justice sanctions versus jail. And again, I don't have any reason to not believe those numbers. Again, I think it's a little simplistic. I've talked to a number of people at length on this, and if you break it down between the operational cost of the jail versus the fixed cost of the jail, you're going to get a much lower number in terms of the actual cost of the jail. We are essentially mandated by the state to have a facility of some kind, right? I mean, that's probably written in the state code somewhere that La Crosse County has to have a jail. We really don't have a choice in that, right? I mean, that's... So I guess I would encourage you to look at what exactly are the operational costs of the jail, and I think you're going to get a little bit different perspective on this.
I don't think that number includes the building, if my memory. I believe, actually, that number is just the operations cost.
Oh, it's the operations? Okay. If you could come back with maybe a disaggregate all those numbers, go through how you got the 95, 75, and how you got the 20, 77.
Sure. It was very easy. I asked our wonderful finance director to give me the cost for what it cost to run the jail and what it cost to run justice sanctions, and I divided it by the number of people who were in bed days, and that's how I got the number. So it wasn't, you know, tough mm-hmm. math. It was math that I can do. So, okay. I mean, that was basically what I did, was I took the overall cost, divided it by the number of bed days either used or saved, and that's all it was.
Okay, because, guys, I mean, I don't need to go into a lot of detail here because we got a long meeting, but I was thinking of operational things like the cost. I mean, you have to have a certain number of jailers, whether you have one person in the jail or 50. So that would, to me, that's a fixed cost. An operational cost would be when somebody comes into the facility, you have to provide them a certain type of clothing, and you have to provide them certain types of things. So those things are dependent on the number of people in the jail, not so much the things that it takes to operate the jail.
Well, I'm sure we could do that, but for the purpose of this presentation, again, to go out to the public, I mean, but I hear where you're coming from, so we can try to figure that out. So.
Sharon.
I just had a question on the slide where you talked about bed days saved. What does that mean in the jail when you have bed days saved? Is that empty beds for that day?
No, I mean, they're actually for the jail, it's bed days used. That's the number of bed days that were used last year, was that 66,000 number. So that's the number of beds that were filled on any given day.
Oh,
so,
okay.
You know, their average daily population was 172. Mm-hmm. So you take 172, multiply that by 365, and you would end up with 66,000.
Okay, thanks.
But it also means, excuse me, jail beds that never had to be built in the first place,
right. Yeah.
Which is the most important part.
I mean, it's not like our jail is sitting empty because there's
right.
many, many repeat customers in the jail, and they're there for good reason. But it means exactly what Steve just said. We're not building a bigger and bigger jail.
John Menninger.
Yeah, thank you. I guess I've been interested in crime and punishment since I read the book by Dostoevsky back at Aquinas High School back in the early 60s, and so I've been fascinated with it for a long time. I just really wanted to say that we've come a long way, and thanking Jane and Keith for their long efforts over many years to make La Crosse really La Crosse County one of the best counties in the state, if not further than that. And my old classmate from Aquinas, Judge Perlich, I'm glad that he straightened out and flew straight.
Joe Billings.
I have a couple comments. The first one is on the residential treatment. We received a very nice presentation by you and Becky Padgy. Did I pronounce her name correctly?
Spangers now, yep.
Okay. And the incredible work that really has been done there, where for years that's been a budget driver, that's been on our minds, and incredible work has been done by you and staff, Becky especially, to bring those numbers down, and the idea that it is a better way to not put someone in residential placement necessarily because they don't learn, as Keith said, they don't learn the tools they need to learn to stay sober in society. And I wish Supervisor Feehan could have been there. He wasn't able to make that meeting. Then about accountability. You know, some people think that these alternatives to jail don't hold people accountable, but actually when I helped set up the OWI court, I remember these negotiations between the DA and the public defender's office. And it was more difficult for some of these people to go through this program. And they just wanted to opt out. Just let me sit my time out in jail. It's a lot more easier. I don't want you involved in so many aspects of my life and have to jump through all these hoops and to take care of my issues. I'd rather just sit in jail. And then finally, I have a question about the women. Do we know specifically when the women will move into the new jail and will close the old jail totally? Do we have a date?
I see Jim Spiropoulos just walked in. What day is it, Jim? Wednesday? Thursday? Wednesday morning. Okay. That's a huge development. Any other questions or comments?
Steve, could I just come into one of the things that Jill just said? You know, I was thinking about this recently, and I don't know if this applies in the chemical health aspect of this, but in the criminal justice system, I liken the use of jail to the use of television with parents. When we have children, most of us think to ourselves, I'm never going to sit my kid in front of a television. I'm never going to put in a movie, right? Just because I'm going to be interactive, I'm going to read stories, and we're going to do make-believe together. But at some point, most of us end up putting our kid in front of a television for whatever reason. I have come to think that jail is sort of like the television. It's an easy way to just make a decision and not give it too much thought. There are much better ways to treat this population, much more effective. In the same way that as a parent, it's much more effective to engage your child's imagination instead of the two-dimensional box in front of them. And that's what we're finding out, is that it's, again, it's more cost-effective, and more importantly, it reduces crime. It changes behavior, and that's really what we're trying to do. But you have to give it some thought. You have to look at the research, and you have to have the programming.
Here's an interesting little statistic. I had two social workers speak to my class today, Jim Fox and Dave Schoonover from our Human Services Department here in the juvenile delinquency area, and they talked about a recent study that showed something quite interesting in terms of why one of the reasons that juvenile crime has gone down in recent couple of years is electronics. Kids are not out breaking windows, breaking into cars. They're at home playing with their Xbox and their Wii. We have a new babysitter that technology has created. So on one hand, it can be bad. On another hand, I guess there might be some positives to that. Not that sitting at home playing with your Xbox is better than doing something socially productive, but there was a study that showed that it is keeping kids from going out on the street. So I'm not advocating for it. I'm just telling you what I heard. Maureen Friedland, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I just think it's I like the approach that you took in this of explaining the changes through the years and where we started and where we are now. And I think it's worth mentioning as you do this that we've come along to the point where we really have developed a philosophy here, and the county board has been able to make its decisions slowly and in most cases pretty close to unanimously or even unanimously. To take the Uber Center down, I think, was pretty close to unanimous. To build a jail a certain size but no bigger because we were going to do these other things was unanimous. And I think it's worth saying that because this really has become a philosophy, and it's become a leading philosophy in the state as well.
Any other questions or comments? Ray Ebert.
Yeah, just for the board members, if you ever get a chance to go see Judge Pacell and talk about deterrence, direct deterrence, general deterrence, he's absolutely fascinating. In 30 minutes, he can give you a primer that's unbelievable, and you really understand it. And just a super, super guy.
And let me encourage you, speaking of Judge Pacell, to some Thursday afternoon at 4 o'clock, go to drug court. You've never seen anything like it before. It would be an eye-opening experience if you could get to there. Every Thursday, Judge Pacell's courtroom, 4 o'clock. Keith, Jane, thank you very much for a very enlightening presentation. And again, a reminder, March 3rd, we have the town hall meeting. All right, that gets us to the next item on the agenda, which I believe is Mr. O'Malley.
Yes. Members of the board, I have the February proclamation, Public Health Month. Just take a moment to thank the Public Health Department who was here. You got a chance, if you got here a few minutes early, to see some of the programming and services that are a small sampling of what our health department does for our community. February 2011, Public Health Month, whereas La Crosse County Health Department improves the quality of life and health of all 110,000 people in La Crosse County, rich and poor residents and tourists, young and old, and whereas the health department is made up of 80 full and part-time staff from the following professions. I won't read all those, but you've got a copy in your agenda packet. Whereas the staff of La Crosse County Health Department assists county residents to live a long and productive life free of preventable disease and preventable injury through the following services. And again, highlights are everything from home health to elderly home visits to tobacco and alcohol prevention, foot care, school vision, and a variety of other services that are listed there. Now, therefore, be it resolved, La Crosse County Board does hereby proclaim that the month of February is Public Health Month and urges all residents to join in recognizing the valuable contribution of health department staff dedicated to improving the quality of life and health for La Crosse County residents.
Moved by Margaret Wood, second by Bill Brockmiller. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried unanimously. He's good.
Okay.
Not as good as Marilyn. She puts more feeling into it. But he did all right.
Well, I'm going to touch on a few things. Gary is handing out both the presentation that I've got coming up in relation to the collective bargaining agreements, but also I realized that I had not handed out from last Thursday night the summary on the state budget and updates in relation to the budget repair bill. I wanted you to have that. I'm not going to review that in detail unless there are questions, but over the last several days, as you know, There isn't a lot of resolution or certainty in what's happening with the state budget repair bill. I think it's quite clear if you've been following it in the news that there is not resolution or movement on either side within the budget repair debate. We continue to be, as a local government, in a position that there's not a lot of certainty of what's going to actually transpire in Madison. You should know that while we've been working on after Thursday last week, where the board unanimously adopted the Hillview collective bargaining agreement on the same basis that we've been bargaining for 5 months now, trying to establish a wage freeze of conditions for the calendar year so that we have enough time to evaluate what the budget is, we've been able to arrive at the same agreement with the other seven bargaining units, and I can touch on some of that. I had expected to hopefully see a little bit more movement, but unfortunately, probably the most disappointing thing is because of the gridlock between the parties, we will not know what the state budget is tomorrow. My hope had been that we would actually have some guidance that the governor and the new administration would not just include us in the discussion about the budget repair bill, but that we would have some clearer idea soon on what the other impacts are of the state budget for the new biennium, not for the current biennium. But I think it's important. I'm going to go over to the podium and talk just for a few minutes and then talk about the labor contracts. Ginny, if you call up the presentation, please. And then if we go to the next slide, let's see if this works. You have all these slides in the handout, and I made them actually larger print than the other evening so that you can actually see this. I think it's important that as you, as the elected policymakers of our community and representatives of the public that are here, that our discussion about labor contracts and our discussion about the budget and the state budget be put into the local context. Basically, just to remind everybody, and you know this because you live it as you make decisions about our budget, is that we're actually a series of 0% controlling in costs across the board. And we're putting ourselves in the best position we can be, even though we're going to be just as challenged as every other county in the state. I think we're better positioned to deal with this. And tonight's discussion about labor contracts actually helps preserve that position. We've just done back-to-back 0% increases in operating levy. I dare say that for 2 years in a row, there are few counties that can match that, given our level of spending that's already lower than most other counties in the state. The county board set the stage when you were elected to this term and said not only were you going to take a 0% increase in your compensation, but you were also going to lower benefits. There was criticism about the level of benefits for county board members. You have actually cut that back and actually restricted the amount of money spent in that area by taxpayers for this entire two-year term. Then you set the stage in August of last year as we were beginning to set a budget that you said to non-union. You said in your resolution that we needed to do a one-year pay freeze to hold the line on health insurance and that to set that as our goal for bargaining units. And that's the position that we've been in discussions with our bargaining units for the last 5 months. So the discussions that you'll have about the resolution before you and that you had last Thursday when you acted on the Hillview resolution is not new. This is not rushing to make a decision. This has been our practice and our direction to establish for the 2011 budget. Next, of course, is a change in health and dental premiums. You'll hear a lot of discussion statewide about how much state employees, teachers, local government employees pay towards health insurance. Our reaction has been that, yes, our employees need to pay towards health insurance. We've had a 90-10 premium share for quite a while. We've had an 80-20 copay share, as well as deductibles and copays. But what we said as an organization was we want to focus on helping employees control costs. We don't want to argue about who pays what premium. We want to help employees be more healthy. We direct programs to help people change smoking behavior, health risk assessments, and those types of things. And that's why we've been able to have a 0% increase in health insurance costs to both employees and to the public through the county. And then finally, we've developed a 0% debt strategy that while we still needed to build a law enforcement center, we needed to figure out a way to level that off. So after this calendar year, we're going to be able to level off debt while we're making two debt payments for the old law enforcement center and the new one so that we will not have to raise property taxes for debt for the next 3 years. In addition to that, we asked our employees to consider something that most other counties weren't doing. They were imposing furloughs on folks, or the state was. We asked for a voluntary unpaid time off program that has only grown over the 2 years that we've offered it. I shared with you last week that it was $240,000 once we added in the roll-up cost, but the FICA savings and the retirement cost savings that are on top of that, it's actually $271,000, so we updated those numbers. And $151,000 of that is by union groups, and $120,000 is by non-union. And then I just wanted to reiterate that we continue to maintain one of the highest bond ratings in the state. We continue to have the fifth lowest per capita spending, according to Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, the fifth lowest per capita spending in tax levy, and the 15th lowest tax rate of all counties. I want to put all this in context, and why I wanted to set the stage before I talk about the union contracts is that's not done by Steve O'Malley. That's done by the county board. It's not done by our finance staff. It's done by a team of people together. It's elected policy leaders, it's administrative staff, and it's our employees, some of them that are here, helping us accomplish that throughout this organization. It's about us pulling together on a local basis to do the best job we can for this community, and part of that today is to ask our employees and us to settle contracts that meet those goals that we talked about and be ready to meet the next level of challenges that we have. I also wanted to include some really big picture items, because when you get the entire county budget and we go through and debate the line items and we say how much we're spending on jail and justice sanctions and courts, sometimes your eyes may glaze over with some of the numbers, but I want to make sure that you understand the county government is different than cities. It's different than schools. It's much different because more of our budget is spent on direct services and less on people. So, for example, if you go to the line items within the budget, you'll notice we're just over $135 million is our total budget. Total wages, and I've never summarized it in this way for you, but I think it's important to put in context, are about 55% of our entire budget is compensation, including wages and benefits. Obviously, we tend to have good benefits. That's why we retain qualified people. But recognize that it's still 55% of our expenditures. Far more of our budget is reliant on federal and state revenue. Far more of our budget is reliant on purchase of services and other capital improvements and those types of things. The other piece that I thought was important to recognize is that our total operating levy for library and total tax levy is only about 18%, 19% of our entire budget. In addition to that, if you add sales tax, it only rises to 25%. So even if we could do everything we could to control wages and compensation, it still will only represent about 45% of our tax levy. So even if every dollar that we spend on sales tax, every dollar that we spend on levy went to compensation, it still would only be paid for approximately by 45% of our levy. So any amount of cut in compensation, like retirement, which is part of the debate that's happening at the state level, doesn't all come back 100% in levy savings. And I'll explain that more in a moment, that, for example, if we were to just have more retirement paid for by highway, it doesn't generate any levy savings. It actually reduces the amount of state revenue. If we have our solid waste employees pay more towards retirement, you can't take money from the solid waste tipping fee and put it to reduce levy. It's a very complicated system, but a savings in employee compensation in general saves about 45% of levy, not 100%. Now, that's not true of every employee. If you save that on my position, which is almost entirely paid by levy, certainly it's 100% levy. But throughout the organization, it's about 45, 46% levy savings if an employee picks up more of their benefits or has a cut in pay. So why would we talk about continuing the course that we've been on to establish a one-year wage freeze when you hear all the things swirling around about changing collective bargaining rights for public employees, imposing midway through the year, this calendar year, requiring people to pay 50% of their retirement? What is the difference between the path that we're recommending as your administrative staff and that the unions have agreed to versus the budget repair bill? And again, wherever you're at on the political spectrum, I just think it's important to look at what the local basis is for why this makes sense, I believe, for La Crosse County. On the left-hand side are our current union agreements, so we have tentative agreements subject to your approval this evening. It's a 0% agreement on wages, 0% and no rise in health insurance and dental costs for both the employer and the employee. But I just want to remind everybody that doesn't mean that employees aren't paying their share. They've been helping us control costs, but are also subject to the 90-10 premiums that I talked about, 80-20 coinsurance, 70-30 if you're out of the network, by the way, as well as deductibles, copays, prescription purchasing restrictions, and those types of things. In addition to that, our employees stepped up and have voluntarily agreed to unpaid time off. That's the equivalent of about an additional 0.5% savings, by the way, that we didn't budget for, that employees have the voluntary ability to do that, and that's as of this point. People still have the ability to continue to do more of that if they choose between now and the end of the year, if they can handle it with their workload. Most of the savings in this context would be levy savings because it's after budget. It actually is directed back to savings within the budget. Now, on the right-hand side, and I didn't do that consciously, but on the right-hand side, the budget repair bill would propose to cap wages, and that would be the only thing that employees could bargain on. The only thing subject to arbitration, by the way, would be a wage. And it would be capped at CPI, or Consumer Price Index, and that an employee group could not get more than that at the bargaining table. Currently, that's 2%. If it changes, of course, that would be part of the subject of arbitration. It's yet to be determined exactly how that would happen, but this is our understanding of the budget bill. Health premiums are referenced in the budget repair bill as being capped at or required employees to have a 12% contribution, but that's for state employees and for those that are part of the state plan. Remember, I hope you do, that every year we look at the state plan, and just as a reminder, in this year, if we would have moved employees from our self-insured plan to the state plan, we would have had to raise premiums for employees and the county by 8%. That's how much more cost-effective our self-insured plan is, and that's why we can do a zero, is that we don't have to have an insurance company or the state plan tell us what our experience is. We're actually able to manage our claims. In addition to that, the budget repair bill requires by law that 50% of WRS would be paid for by the employee, which amounts to about a 5.8% cut in wage, except for protective service. By the way, I think it's a good important point to note that all seven bargaining units are here, including protective service. The protective service law enforcement officers said that, yes, they understand that they would be exempt in the future, but in solidarity, they've asked for the same agreement and have voted in favor of one of the seven contracts, our law enforcement staff, asking to be treated the same way as other bargaining units. And again, on the budget repair bill, it's my expectation that many people would not voluntarily do the unpaid time off if the budget repair took 5.8% away from them. So we would have to, by law, give a 2% at minimum because someone could go to arbitration if they chose and get that 2%. We would return the savings to the county budget of 5.8% taken out of employees' pockets, but we would not get the voluntary UTO, in my opinion, because most of us, particularly non-union, are relooking at whether or not we can do that because we're not protected by a labor contract. If the law is imposed, it will happen to all of us non-union that don't have the right of collective bargaining, again, by law. Again, 40% to 50% of the reduction would be levy savings. The rest would be an imposition of cost to employees, but it would not help our property tax levy. Because again, most of about half of our budget, about 55%, is paid for by other revenue. So if you go to the next cycle, the budget agreement. Let's actually compare compensation and what ends up happening. I believe the union agreements provide us some certainties, and waiting for the budget repair bill leaves a lot of uncertainties. First of all, the union agreements, we need support of our employees to meet the challenges ahead. If we establish this contract for 1 year and give us time to adapt to all the things that the state and federal government are doing in funding, our focus with employees can be how are we going to meet the challenges, not discussing or redebating what's actually happening. We're not going to avoid the challenges. If the state imposes a 5.8% decrease on employees and other kinds of cuts in services, we can't avoid that beyond this current year. We're going to have to deal with that. But we can engage our employees in what ways of redesigning services, what ways of changing services, and how we can end up coming up creatively with ways of dealing with this challenge. There isn't any magic answer. If the state chooses to impose that, and I understand, I read over the weekend that a number of union reps have said that they're willing to take these concessions, they just want to preserve bargaining rights. I don't know what's going to happen out of all of this, but the point is we know counties are going to have to take a hit. We know employees are going to have to take changes in benefits, but it gives us the year to deal with that rather than imposing it on people within the next 30 days. It gives us time to deal with that. In addition to that, I think employees are more likely to honor the UTO commitment that they've made, and I've even had employees suggest that perhaps as part of dealing with some of the budget issues, we should look at involuntary furloughs of a day or two to end up gaining additional. Now, I've been reluctant to recommend that to you, but let's see what the whole overall budget context is. And again, most levy savings under the existing budget, because it's what we've budgeted, would be levy savings within this adopted budget. On the right-hand side, there are many uncertainties. The bill is subject to change. I've heard a number of Republican senators talk about different ways of adjusting this. They've talked about actually making employees pay even more into retirement. They've also talked about delaying what the impact is of when it happens. I've heard, obviously, Democratic senators asking for compromise. But even if the bill passes in its current form, it's unlikely to pass within the next week, which means that the impact right now is that it has to happen by the March 13th payroll, effective with the April 8th day. I think I've got that right, Bill, that it's effective with the March 13th as it's currently written. So the earliest that could be imposed is April 8th. We're running out of time to actually make the payroll changes if it's not adopted soon, much like you'll hear the Secretary of Administration talk about. They're running out of time to be able to do some of the refinancing. Again, while I have a strong opinion and you know that, I'm not making necessarily a political judgment. What I'm talking about is on the right-hand side are a lot of uncertainties about when it would happen and how it would happen and how we can even administer being able to implement it. Right now, as it's proposed, that the 5.8% cut would, in essence, affect employees that are not under contract that are not, or the non-union for 9 months. If it's delayed additionally, you don't save even as much, even though it doesn't save all levy. So there are a number of moving parts here. It will not avoid the law. The law will be imposed at the end of whatever that contract is for our Hillview employees and for the other unions that you'll be talking about. It will be imposed on non-union employees as whatever the law says. But the CPI generally is for a full year. It's quite often that you end up settling wage increases all the way retroactively. Now, during my time here and during most of the time that I've been serving you, we've been able to give you labor contracts that are voluntarily settled before adoption, before the new year starts. This is the first year since I've been here that we haven't been able to do that. Also on the right-hand side, again, is I think we're unlikely to have the UTO savings. So I, along with Mary Powell and Gary, we ran some spreadsheets to actually see, and you've got the detail there, and I can answer more questions on this. On the left-hand side, we've budgeted for a 0% increase. We budgeted for Wisconsin retirement, which is the central focus that shows and compares wages, WRS, voluntary UTO, and savings of all bargaining units, including Hillview. So you see on the left-hand side is the 0% that we've budgeted. WRS is already budgeted without a change. Voluntary UTO would save us in levy an additional $151,000 just from union employees. On the right-hand side, if we gave the 2% increase for the full year, which is my best guess, my professional estimate, that that's what the arbitrator would give if we went to arbitration, if that was the only subject of arbitration under what's being proposed, the 5.8% cut would be imposed for 9 months, because that's what the law is written to right now. Again, that would save a little bit over $489,000, but only 45% of that would be levy, so it would save about $220,000. So about $60,000 more than our current path. That's if it's adopted and implemented for 9 months. Now, without making a whole lot of changes or assumptions, would CPI go up by the time we made it into arbitration? Would people change their decision about UTO? I only changed one thing, which is to change that estimate to 8 months. Anyone that's watching what's going on believes that this may take another month to come to an agreement. Use the example where the Texas senators left for a month. They came back. They ended up settling basically what that governor and legislature wanted, but it delayed the imposition for a month. It has a cost item. What that does is it changes the implementation of the 5.8% cut, and you end up seeing then 45%. It's almost a net-net the same impact for these eight bargaining units, the one that you already settled and this one. There's almost very little change. Now, that doesn't avoid the law. What it does is avoid the uncertainty during this current calendar year and puts us in a position. Now, the other piece that I want you to understand is we're talking about people's livelihoods. We're talking about people, many people that don't make a great deal of money, that aren't in management, that are your neighbors, that serve your public. And so we put together some examples that you should see one of the reasons why the bargaining units have come together and asked us to give them more time to help work with us, that over a period of time, this is the kind of impact. The lowest paid support service worker in Hillview, that the contract that you just approved on Thursday, makes $8.60 an hour, not a lot of money. $17,000, this cut, had they had to receive the 5.8%, is a $1,000 cut in their take-home. Regardless of deductions, regardless of everything else, that is very difficult. Now, that's not philosophy. Whether you think employees should pay more towards benefits or not, in the public sector, you don't have the option to not be in the Wisconsin retirement system. If you are a private sector employee making $8.60 an hour and your employer offers you a retirement package, you can say, I'm not going to take $1,000 out. I can't afford to do this. I'm only going to be here for a couple of years. I'm going to move on to another employer. And then if we keep going down, the Hillview nursing assistant, again, is very similar. We'll lose $1,600. A clerical, just an average clerical position in the downtown campus, making $30,000 or $15 an hour, many of them single moms, a $1,700 impact, right like that, with only 30 days notice without the labor contracts that we're talking about. A heavy equipment operator, which is on par with what is in the private sector, would take a hit of $2,500. And finally, a registered nurse, where we're really competing in the marketplace trying to find registered nurses. And again, these are all from exact wages. Not every registered nurse makes exactly the same. These are this is the top step, by the way, of a Lakeview nurse at $2,759. That's a $3,300 decrease in pay. Now, yes, county employees will have to step up and be a part of the budget solution if that's happened. But I just thought you should know this is the type of impact to folks. The shift is an actual push of cost to employees. I'd also like to call on Bob Taunt to talk about, just to give some background on what's in the resolution, the language items that are there as well, and just to wrap this up.
Okay, before we have Bob talk, I'm going to have Tara put this on the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have item 2-19 to the honorable members of the La Crosse County Board of Supervisors, a resolution regarding adoption of 2011 collective bargaining agreements for the following unions: AFSCME Local 2484, Professional, Paraprofessional, and Clerical, Lakeview Employees, Highway and Parks Employees, Jailers, WPPA Sheriff's Deputies, and the Telecommunicators. Whereas La Crosse County has concluded collective bargaining negotiations, and whereas the parties have reached a voluntary tentative agreement on all issues raised through collective bargaining, including a wage freeze, now therefore be it resolved that the tentative agreements of the parties, a summary of which is attached hereto, for contract changes for year 2011, including across-the-board wage freeze, be ratified as the changes to the working agreement between La Crosse County and the local 2484 Paraprofessional Employees Union, effective as specified in the agreements ratified by the union. Be it further resolved that the County Board Chair, County Administrator, and Personnel Director are authorized to sign the collective bargaining agreements as amended upon approval of the Corporation Council. Be it further resolved that the Personnel and Finance Departments are authorized and directed to take such action as is necessary to put said working agreement into effect and carry out the intent of this resolution. The fiscal note is the net impact is 0.6% for WRS, or approximately $154,600 for all units. Funding for this increase has been included in the 2011 budget. The number of employees in the units are approximately, in the professional unit, 121 employees, paraprofessionals and clerical, 246, Lakeview employees, 207, highway and parks employees, 59, jailers, 53, WPPA sheriff's deputies, 28, and telecommunicators, 23. I move its approval and note that in committee, it was adopted on a 7-0 vote with two absences.
Moved by Tara Johnson, seconded by Bill Brockmiller. Steve, do you have any further comments, or Bill? Or, I mean, Bob.
I just thought Bob could wrap up what's happened in the last few days and just bargaining history on the work we've done.
Well, this is the culmination of bargaining that took place or started back in September, October. We had many, many meetings with our seven units here and Hillview as well. And the tentative agreements are on the back page here, and they're very meager. These are unusual times, and this is an unusual settlement. Usually we're trying to get a two-year book, a two-year contract. This is a one-year. And with the wage freeze, as we've consistently said with the bargaining units, the times are so up in the air right now that we can't see ahead into 2012. We don't have the governor's budget. And so we have proposed the one-year agreement with the wage freeze to help the budget. The health and dental insurance premiums are not increasing. We're picking up the WRS increase, and there's some leveling out of the sick leave cap and the credit towards retirement across all units, and there's some other minor housekeeping changes, and you can see some of those. It's really, there's not a whole lot in these programs, but as we've said, we're kind of treading water for 2011. And waiting to see how the dust settles on the governor's budget.
First of all, let's start out with any questions anybody has for Bob or for Steve. Any questions for them? Okay, Ray Ebert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vacation pay, what's the maximum amount of vacation pay you can carry over or whatever? And then at the end of your career, what can you do with vacation pay? I assume that's by contract.
Right. The maximum vacation we have is 5 weeks after 20 years.
No, how much can you accumulate? Can you, is that, so it's 5 weeks, the most you can
and
carry over
you can
and sell at
you
the
can
end of your career or whatever?
You can accumulate twice that towards retirement. No one is there yet.
And then you can sell that for cash dollars at the end of your career or what?
No, it's not. The vacation is used to apply towards health insurance in retirement.
So the same as sick leave is done?
Yeah. I'm sorry, what's your question?
So that's the same that sick leave, accumulated sick leave, you use both of those the same
the
for
sick
retirement?
Leave can, the
benefits.
Sick leave goes directly in. Your vacation is your benefit that you can choose which direction you want to put it. You can put it in a deferred compensation program. You can cash it out because it's a vacation benefit.
Thank you, sir.
Other questions for Bob? Bill Feehan.
I just want to clarify what I just heard there. So according to the current contract, they can claim 75% of their accumulated sick and vacation days, and the way that those are collected in retirement is they are deferred compensation. Is that what you just said?
No. The vacation, the maximum that you can accumulate after 20 years of service, you work up to 5 weeks of vacation. You can accumulate double of that if you don't use any of your vacation. You can take that as cash out on retirement 100% because that's vacation days that you can use or cash out on retirement.
So that's 10 weeks potentially?
Yes.
And that's at 75% or 100%?
No, it's at 100%.
Is that affected by, if we were not to approve this contract and the governor's budget repair bill went through, would that be affected?
I don't believe so, no.
So
it's that the 5 weeks has been in the contracts for years and years. The vacation system that we have now is it's a newer system. It's a modern system that provides for earning a vacation each paycheck instead of a lump sum given one time a year.
And how does it apply to sick days?
The sick days is what you see in number 5 of the tentative agreements. Over the years, you earn about one sick day per month, 12 a year. You can accumulate up to 150 days. That's many years of not taking any sick. And on retirement only, you can use 85% of that as a credit towards retirement health insurance or health expenses. The money is deposited into an HRA account, health reimbursement account, or into an account to pay for health insurance.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think any of us have actually seen the agreement.
The summary is all we attach to this. If you'd like to see the language, we have it.
Yes, I would like to see the nature of our agreement that we're about to vote on. And I will say that contrary to the administrator's characterization, I do feel like this is being rushed in light of the pending law from the state. I appreciate the information that's been brought before us tonight. However, I have a lot of questions about this, and to my way of thinking, this is being rushed, and I would like to have more time to understand what the implications are.
Well, I think a lot of people would like to have more time, but somebody a little bit to the east of us won't allow that.
Whoa, wait a minute. Why this was supposed to come to us before the beginning of the year. Isn't that what the administrator just said?
I believe
normally it comes before the beginning of the year.
No, actually, before I was the administrator, it would take a long time, and quite often you do retroactive pay. We established a practice where we were able to get voluntary agreements before contract. That's unusual. A lot of counties are doing retro.
Well, I believe in previous board meetings, we discussed that this agreement was going to come to us probably in January. And so it does feel to me like we aren't being given time to even understand these numbers. I can't believe I'm the only person in this room who found that long series of calculations somewhat confusing. 5.8% of the $50 million payroll comes out to $2.9 million, and there were a lot of other calculations I was trying to follow along with. My concern is that we don't rush into a decision that ties our hands later this year after the budget repair bill passes. And I am somewhat convinced by the argument that you've made, but it would have been nice to have had this information to have been able to gone through and make those calculations so that I can have peace of mind about what I'm voting on here tonight. And that concludes my comments for now.
Tara Johnson has an amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the "now therefore be it resolved" clause, if you can look at that for a minute, we need to add in the third line following the words "agreement between La Crosse County," we need to replace the words "and the local 2484 paraprofessional employees union" with the following: "local 2484 professional, semicolon, paraprofessional and clerical, semicolon, Lakeview employees, semicolon." And just for note, this is what's in the heading of the resolution itself. It's that same wording. "Semicolon, highway and parks employees, semicolon, jailers, semicolon, WPPA sheriff's deputies, semicolon, and telecommunicators." And then it would continue, "effective as specified in the agreements ratified by the union."
Is there a second to that? Second by Vicki Burke. Anything further from staff? Any other presentation that it? Okay. Discussion on, well, let's just take care of that amendment right away. All in favor of the amendment, say aye. Opposed, no. Carried unanimously. Okay, discussion or questions on the resolution as amended. Mr. Mina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since I was probably on the board for quite a few years, and with Gary and Bob, we did negotiate contracts for probably 10 or 12 years since I was on the board, and we had a committee made up of six or seven people, and we did negotiate over the years gone by. I would just suggest that when you start next year's negotiations, you open one meeting up to the board members to get a flavor of what we do and how we do it with the union workers. I guess I believe that this is a good contract, and I would suggest we approve it tonight.
Further discussion? Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the resolution as amended, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried unanimously. One abstention, that is Mr. Feehan. I would like to thank the employees who are here today for all of the work that you do for us 365 days a year.
Mr. Chair, I have one more comment.
Mr. O'Malley.
As we're going through these troubled times, I do think it's important to note, if you didn't realize, that while many of our employees have participated in some of the rallies and the items down in Madison, and this isn't a criticism of any other public employees, our employees have found ways to utilize vacation, unpaid time off, and continue to maintain services while they've been attending these rallies. Because, as I know one of the union presidents, Mary Spell, talked about, and when I've talked with her, the clients in our community are still the most important thing. Even with all these challenges, they've stood up and made sure the roads are plowed, the roads are patrolled, the jail is still operating. The community is still having its needs met, and I just wanted to point that out, that while they've still been maintaining their own political rights and position, they've been meeting our community's needs, and I want to publicly thank them for that while they're trying to act.
Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, at the risk of imposing an awkward request for County Administrator O'Malley and the other members of the management team. I would like for March, possibly April, if you need more time, just to hear, starting an executive committee, any kind of options that there might be for the unrepresented employees and what we might be able to look at. We'll know more about budget repair bill and its dispensation and the budget for next year and so forth. But we've, I think, done an amazing thing here in La Crosse County in the past several days. But there is a huge, equally important group of employees who have no protection right now. And I would like to see suggestions or options for us, please, to look at how we might help them.
I want to offer another very strong thank you to Steve O'Malley and his team, including the folks up here, plus Bob and Mary and Mary Powell, for the hours and hours and hours that they have spent over the last week or so crunching through all of this. I have more phone calls and emails than I can count to and from Mr. O'Malley on this issue. I know he's been working around the clock, including weekends, trying to make this work. And I think that they deserve our thanks also in terms of the effort that they have put into this. Continuing on the agenda, cards and correspondence are over there. Committee meetings are none during recess. Anybody have any suggestions for future agenda items? Steve, you have something? Yes.
Just to point out, Gary brought an update. We some good news for once on the financial front. We made budget on sales tax revenue. We shared this with you last week without the totals when we didn't have December. There's a little sign of hope that things are turning around retail sales-wise, at least locally, and we made budget. So that's very good news for 2010.
John Menninger.
The budget was, I believe, $9 million.
$675,000.
So we made about $75,000 more.
By the way, we budgeted 9.5 in 2011, so we were a little bit more conservative. So if we make the same amount, then we're doing a little better.
Anybody else have any future agenda items? Seeing none, is there a motion to adjourn? Jerry Sobranek, do you have any words of wisdom, or will we have to wait?
As a matter of fact, I do. A boy asked his father, are the Indians superior to us? The father answered, well, in an Indian village, they don't pay taxes, they have no debt, no need for a telephone or a computer, they don't pay union dues, they get up when they want, go to bed when they want, and hunt and fish when they want, and the women do all the work. But we can talk about that later, because I don't want to miss my bus to the casino. That's it. I move the adjourn.
Is there a second? Bill Brockmiller, all in favor say aye. Opposed, no. Carried unanimously.